Welcome to the special edition of Full Prefrontal, the Big Picture series. Coupled with our extensive library of conversations with leaders in the fields of neuroscience and cognitive, educational, and social psychology, in this special series, Sucheda plans to dive deeper into the science of executive function, including managing oneself and one's cognitive resources in order to achieve goals. Throughout the Big Picture series, we'll explore the difference between knowing and doing. She will share real-life examples and day-to-day tips for practicing intentional strategies to help you, your family, your team members, or your students build competencies in executive function to lead to stronger, more resilient relationships, sustainable communities, and fulfilling lives together. And now here is our host, Sucheda Kamath. Welcome back to Full Prefrontal, where we are exposing the mysteries of executive function. As always, I'm here with our host, Sucheda Kamath. Good morning, my friend. Looking forward to our conversation today.
Good morning. How are you, Todd? I'm so excited to be with you.
Well, this is going to be a really fun conversation on this special edition Big Picture episode. We're going to talk about no ordinary play today. What a fun conversation. So, gosh, I guess in thinking about this topic, I don't really need a definition of play, but looking at it from the perspective of science, what is play? What do we need to know about it?
Yes, I know you probably were a little surprised when I chose this topic, and maybe the listeners too, but I thought, we are always talking about something very serious, but something fun and meaningful and lively, which has incredible value to executive function, we must talk. So yes, here we are discussing play. So this entire episode, by the way, was inspired by the work of a very famous psychiatrist, Stuart Brown, who is the founder of the National Institute of Play, who also has a book by that name called Play. So Oxford Dictionary has at least 50 definitions of the word play. But to start with, play is anything that spontaneously is done for its own sake. This definition can be further extended into more and more detailed definitions, which includes words like purposeless activity, produces pleasure and joy. But play may look, seemingly purposeless, voluntary act that is fun to do, but the emphasis is on apparently purposeless act. Because unlike other basic drives where eating, sleeping, resting, play doesn't appear to be a must for survival, but we are wrong there. It's taken a long time for the scientists to see the connection why mammals play, particularly all those animals, including humans, who live in groups, have found play to have an important role. So it has an inherent quality of boundlessness, and it harbors potential for improvisation, such that in essence, play is shapeless activity that can be shaped into anything we want it to be.
Well, I mean, play is play. We all have an immediate image that comes to mind when we think of that, but we have to take it very seriously, yes?
Yes. So scientists, including biologists, psychologists, neuroscientists, they all are beginning to understand that the play has a primal role in human development. And it's thought to have a role of a building block for empathy. Play is inherently attractive as it loops in the desire to keep ongoing, and it fires off endorphins in the brain, which is what gives great sense of joy and happiness. But it also helps one connect with others, offers healing, builds a social understanding, and it helps in learning effectively, which in fact translates into forming bonds with others. So it might sound like I'm on my soapbox, but I'm really a big fan of play. So let's bring play back. Let's bring recess back. Let's bring physical education, music, games, art, etc. back into the classrooms, into child's education. And more importantly, Todd, that parents need to really liberate their children and allow them to have free play, particularly the rough and tumble, which looks on the surface a little bit hard play, but it's not.
Well, I recall recess from my childhood, and now that I understand its power, recess should never have gone away as adults. So obviously, play is very important, but there's a lot of people out there who think otherwise. My mom told me a million stories about how the nuns in her Catholic school would, play was not part of the expectation. They would rather have had the kids be seen and not heard.
Yes. And I grew up in India, and we were also quite kind of playing quietly was really emphasized somehow, or being rough and loud was somehow obnoxious or rude or unhealthy. I don't know. But, you know, the bad rap comes from this rough and tumble play, which is often appears aggressive or dangerous. But that has a very important role in human development. Animals seems to be doing it. Humans do it. There's a particular posturing that goes on that also shows that you're ready to pounce on somebody, but that pounce is not an attack. So this is all done in effort to gain handle on situations. Play, rough and tumble plays, for example, teach how to kind of develop socially and understand how to handle aggression. So it's kind of a pretend aggression to know, prepare yourself for the real aggression. You know, throughout centuries, the myth about play, though, has spread like fire. You know, somehow it appears that it's useless and directionless. And myths perpetuate this thought process that play is simply unimportant, is frivolous act, something that has to be done, you know, and it's because it looks purposeless, it's meaningless. So that's why, I don't know if you know, you don't have kids, but when my kids were born and we were raising them, there was like a big movement to buy these Einstein, you know, motivated like musical toys and things like that. So people are now overcorrecting and doing structured play, you know, like instead of free play. So yes, we do need to kind of wipe out some of these misconceptions.
So I'm still thinking about when you said that we are wired to play, and it makes me better understand sometimes why I just happen to be in a playful mood, or I observe my dog suddenly start doing some goofy, playful stuff. Because of this being wired notion, I mean, I'm assuming that we send play signals out to each other.
Yeah. And you know, I've been reading a lot in preparation for this, but I've also been thinking a lot about this, particularly working with children and adults with executive dysfunction. The idea of taming children who are misbehaving or who are rambunctious, there's a lot of effort focused on discipline and quieting down the movements. And what is lost is this evolutionary brain that this brain grew exponentially when humans became culturally attuned. So when the culture came about, the culture is nothing but navigating social interactions in group living, and play became a very critical part of navigating that culture. So it's an essential element of shaping the brain's infrastructure, and it, in return, it shapes the organism's brain and makes it even more robustly wired. You know, Jane Goodall once said that it's giving youngsters practice. This kind of play gives youngsters practice, the kind of skills you need to become adult. All animals are social, and hence play is critical. So, you know, play certainly makes us stronger and more adaptable. It enables us social, sustainable skills that allow you to be sustaining relationships in social context. And it fuels creativity and innovation. And we'll hear about that in a minute when we have a little bit of a innovative approach to today's podcast, which is my way of playing with the podcast. So finally, you know, there are two ways to think about the act of play and how it serves a vital function. First, it's an anxiety-free activity. That means it takes your mind off of stresses and worries, and that without having to define goals. And second, it gives you an opportunity to simulate the future. So that's why play has an incredible evolutionary role.
Mm. Boy, I'm awash in memories of my childhood now, listening to you talk and remembering all my playful experiences. But I have to guess that we play earlier than that, right? I mean, there's play between a mother and a child, right? I mean, that gaze into each other's eyes for, I don't know, maybe there's no specific reason, but and it's always quite a beautiful thing to watch. But that's play, isn't it?
Oh, yes. And you know what you're describing, and so astute of you, you're describing something called attunement. Psychologists talk a lot about attunement. This is being in harmony with the other. And so the early play is between mother and a child. And in fact, children with autism, children with any social emotional disorders tend to have poor attunement, which, again, one of the elements of that attunement is that being in synchrony with the other, emotional synchrony, and eyes are locked in. This kind of play strengthens the emotional bond between the two parties that are involved. So I remember my father, who was a chess champion, he had a great knack for play, and he used to play chess, he used to play bridge. And then he also, you know, as he became very busy, and we were teenagers, he would have these bridge championships and practices. So he used to travel all around the world. Not the world, but India to take part in bridge competitions. And he would have a partner. And what fascinated me that, you know, there would be two teams. So two pairs would show up and then they would play this bridge. And I don't know much about bridge, but it would go on and on. And my father, to me, what looked like was not as sharp as my father was, but my father had him as a partner and he would yell and scream and they would like the game would be over and then they would be shouting and screaming and he would be discussing like, why didn't you do this? Why didn't you do that? And they both had like a secret meeting. They would step out on the deck and they would have a little quick powwow and set a new set of signals and they would go back and start a new game. It was hilarious because in that moment, I would see my father, who was 50 then, would be fighting like a child and yelling and screaming and then making up and then also kind of conspiring against the other team. So yes, this kind of attunement continues throughout our life and brings a great sense of joy and closeness to the other.
Mm, lots to think about here. I mean, I'm assuming that both parents and our teachers should be equally interested in watching and certainly promoting play if they want to see their kids or their students grow and thrive. I mean, so what should they be thinking about when they're doing this?
You know, that's a very interesting question and an important one. Because we are here talking about executive function, I want to circle back to this idea is executive function is kind of pursuing your goals by organizing your thoughts and organizing your steps and creating a path to attain the goals that you have for self. And along the way, what is a really critical element is problem solving. How do you handle the challenge that you run into? And those kinds of things are best done where most learning happens, which is in school. So the parents and educators are keenly interested in two areas of growth in school-aged children. One, how they master academics. And second, how they interact and relate to their peers and form bonds, right? So one without the other will truly be incomplete childhood experience. So the research shows that early play engagements and pro-social behaviors predict and directly contribute children's developmental trajectories in social and academic domains. So pro-socialness in play really can be listed as cooperating, helping, sharing, consoling. And if it's not done well, then it might be considered as being antisocial. So if a child that doesn't get enough exposure and experience and really joy of play, they tend to be prone to verbal and physical aggression. So it's really, really important.
Well, hearing all this, I mean, now I can't even imagine a childhood where a child has not been able to play. I mean, I can't even fathom that. I mean, I suppose not playing or not engaging in playful activities is probably quite harmful, yes?
Yeah, and you know, it's so interesting. Dr. Stuart Brown that I mentioned in the top of the episode here, his work started by studying prisoners, so people who are on death row, and he began to investigate a lot of social psychological problems that they had, which brought their aggression and hostility, and they acted on it, not having regard for how these actions impact the other. And one consistent theme that emerged was very poor exposure to play, or very poor play life in childhood. So for certain, to play is to be human. And as we have been talking about here, play keeps mind and brain flexible to cope with constantly changing world. And play is what leads to lightheartedness, empathy, optimism, hopefulness for the future, and adaptability. And by the way, all this, Dr. Stuart describes it this way. But I feel that those who grow up with play deficits often experience mild and chronic depression, and they often have experiences of inflexibility, or others around them might describe inflexibility. So such individuals can be difficult to deal with. So it's really, really important for us to think about this underexposure to play can be harmful.
Well, as I said earlier, all I can think about now is all the play I did as a child. And a couple of things come to mind. I remember enormous amounts of physical activity. So I now realize how helpful that was in terms of developing strength and health and vigor as a child in running around and just activity that I worried today's kids aren't getting. I think about all the building I did, Legos and Lincoln Logs and blocks and all that. So I now realize that was fueling my creativity. And this is the other thing I never realized how important it was, but hearing you talk earlier, I mean, the role play that this is and the social training. I mean, I played house. I remember the girl.
Oh, did you?
I remember the girl who was my next door neighbor. Her name was Erin. She was probably my first crush, but she was my wife and I was the husband. And I imagine, Sujata, I mean, I'm now realizing, but that was social training, was it not? I mean, that's, I'm now realizing even more so how important this is.
Yeah. And I think you grew up as a single child, didn't you? So this was even more critical.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So not having your siblings who are your peers, you know, I'm so happy to know that you had your neighbors and even being a girl, you kind of, you know, connected and you deeply shared these activities that brought you together and allowed you to kind of sort out. So play is really where we sort things out. And this practice of having to sort out is nothing but in the executive function context, we can talk about creating mental templates. So what larger the repertoire of these mental templates, greater the opportunities to come up with multiple solutions. And in the literature, this is often called as a play histories. It's a very wonderful exercise. And those who are listening to this podcast, I highly encourage over dinner tonight, you know, sit down with your loved one and ask them about their play history. That will tell you so much about their lives, as well as check it out if they had any play deficits. But, you know, me, rather than just sharing this with you, why don't we listen to this conversation that we recorded with Lisa and her sister, Laurie. I can't wait to just share that. And why don't we listen to that now? So I have with me Lisa Campbell Harper and her sister Laurie Pennell. Welcome, guys. I'm so happy to have you.
Hey, thank you.
Great to be here.
So can you share with us some of the things you did in your childhood and the way you played with each other? When you told me this casually in a conversation, it was so fascinating. And I said to myself, we have to have our audience listen to it. So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I was basically just describing that for us, you know, play was just literally what we did all day, every day. And often our play was just this huge adventure. And mostly the adventure was something that we created in our minds. But a large part of how we played was really just describing that adventure to each other. And while sometimes we played with our dolls and we played house and we played sort of maybe everyday things, I think often we played like huge crises.
That's how I remember it.
Or a flood, or we were being chased. And a large part of our play was just describing like who we were as characters. Like maybe we were a mother and we had to have a very specific name. And we had five children that we were carrying with us. And how old were they and what were their names?
Oh, I think that was more like a dozen. And those children had their pets and all they had to lug around too.
And then we had to describe, you know, what was the scene? Well, we were traversing through the mountains, which, you know, might have been our backyard. And then we had to swing on a vine to get across this particular canyon, which was the swing set or the trapeze on the swing set. And every little moment of whatever it was that we were playing had to really be thought through. We weren't just wearing a dress. We were wearing a purple gingham dress with, you know, a strap here for the teddy bear to cling to. Something very, very detailed.
So, Laurie, what do you remember? What stood out for you?
Well, I was a middle sister, so, you know, I learned a lot by watching the successes and mistakes of my older and younger sisters. But I remember that we read a lot of books, and often they were maybe many grades higher than our age. Our parents were both kind of teacher personalities, and so we had a lot of books, a lot of educational toys and things like that. So I think it was the stories that we were reading that we were always acting out in our playing. You know, and my being younger, Lisa was often reading books that were a little more advanced than what I was reading. So, you know, maybe she was reading about Hitler. I was reading about, you know, birthday parties. And so some of those scenarios that she was reading about, since she was the older sister and, you know, the leader, you know, she would put these scenarios that, you know, Hitler was coming and we were playing Barbies, but we must help the Barbies escape Hitler. And so shoeboxes turned into barges and Barbies were tucked in and piled in on top of each other. We had to hurry, hurry, hurry before, you know, Hitler came. And as a younger child, I think, you know, I grew up not really knowing, you know, what is this Hitler character? What are we escaping from? But I think it had a lot to do with reading and all the stories that Lisa was hearing. And then she would translate those into her play with her younger sister. So
I think that's so exciting. And I mean, one of the things that really strikes out for me is you are experiencing these emotions that in an ordinary day you wouldn't have. So if you are in a flood or a fire, the crisis that leads to this sense of anxiety and fear, and one of the benefits, and I don't mean to bring neuroscience into this, but the experience of having to experience these emotions that are not invoked in daily activities is what makes play so much fun. You get to experience how to bounce back. So do you mind both of you telling us a little bit about how did, I mean, this is a little bit of now connecting the dots here, but how would you say play influenced you as an adult, and what kind of role play has in your life now?
Well, I would say that I think for me, a large part of what I do every day in my professional role and even in my personal role in the family is around organizing and planning for long-term big things that may have many, many moving parts and pieces. And so kind of that ability to imagine what an end state might look like and to be able to think through lots of details that don't exist is something that I played a lot at doing and that I really enjoy doing. And another way that we played was often sort of in training for something, which sort of sounds funny, but we might be using our bikes as horses one day, right? And we were training for a national, you know, rodeo or jumping competition, or this swimming pool might be our gymnastics field, and we were practicing for hours. You know,
for the Olympics.
Right. So this idea of, you know, mapping out a goal maybe is one thing that I see as I think back on, you know, how do I do that still? How do I incorporate that into my life?
That's really crazy and amazing. How about you, Laurie?
Well, I'm a little stumped by the question because I feel like I play every single day. I know I'm an adult. I'm going to turn 50 this year, but I don't know that I ever really stopped playing. As an artist and a writer, I just feel like the imagination side of who I was as a child never went anywhere. In what I do professionally, I'm paid to come up with ideas and they need to be out of the box. And it's always been such fun for me because, you know, we never played inside of a box growing up. So I don't know about those boxes, but I think back to the idea of the books that we read growing up, we also read a lot of picture books. And they always had these beautiful illustrations. My mother never got us, you know, ugly books. There was no subpar illustration. And to me, a lot of what I learned and how I played as a child, I still use today. You know, I'm not ever designing anything that is ugly or jarring. It's always got a sense of adventure, something unexpected, a little bit of a surprise or a twist, or there's always something fun and whimsical in every work project that I do, because I think that's just who I am based on the amazing childhood I had.
Wow. I mean, this just listening to you and knowing your professions, I don't know you as well as I know Lisa, but the creativity, the spontaneity, deeply thought out action plan, and sounds like this idea of innovation is really at the heart of how you both choose to live your lives. And of course, I'm stretching here, but I do see a play having an incredible role there. So thank you guys for coming on the show and contributing and sharing and making it so fun.
Yeah, let's go play.
We're happy to come play anytime.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Wow, Sucheta, that was a lot of fun. You know, one word I can describe that in, that's called whimsy. And I realize how lacking we are in whimsy in today's world. And I recognize how much that comes from play. But I love how they describe their play as adventure. And how important is that in the development of a child? I loved that they went into detailed descriptions of things. Instead of just saying that I was wearing a dress, I was wearing, I couldn't remember what she said, but some specific kind of dress with a color and a strap. I mean, how important is that descriptive side of this thing? And then, you know, the obvious thing, as you know, it's important to me, is that they read a lot of books, and that's all good stuff.
Yes. And I think what's so clear, were you noticing the mastery on language?
Oh, yeah.
you know, that this is what it does. You know, it builds these fundamental skills that we consider so vital for education and learning and development. They had a very robust life outside the classroom, which is what I love, listening to the imagination that went into crafting such elaborate projects, you know, elaborate catastrophes. I don't think I've ever met anybody who actually simulated a catastrophe and say, let's pretend that we are stuck in a flood. That's so great. That's why I loved having them both. You know, as you can see, this way of tracing one's own play history is like tracing one's origin, you know, of your lighthearted self. This is how we find our ways back to who I was. Where did I begin to become this easygoing, you know, carefree, but deeply person who deeply loves life? So you can trace all the signs of imaginative and symbolic play that are taking, you know, taking shape as the child engages. And one of the important things here, as you saw, there was no interference from an adult. So I often find this concept of play dates fascinates me. And I kind of find it a little bit annoying that the parents are in the background. They're kind of saying, Coco, why don't you offer him some ice cream? You know, or why don't you take out these Legos and see if he wants to play with that? I also notice in the work that I do, kids often get bored on a play date. That means they have nothing to say to each other and they can't seem to navigate this place where they have to cajole the other person to join on the fun that they have crafted. So yes, that's why play is so essential, because that's how our early negotiations begin there.
Well, listening to them talk and then thinking about my own experience and then just other observations over my life, we seem to play using our hands a lot. I mean, I have to assume that that has some influence on the brain and the ultimate outcomes of this, right? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, research in executive function talks a lot about motor planning skills, which is execution, by the way, before we execute anything. Execution requires a motor execution, doing. So executive functions very exclusively relate to taking action, not contemplating and thinking. That's not alone executive function. So if we think about it that way, you know, play is very powerful in that regard because it inherently emphasizes learning by doing. So David Kelly has coined the term called thinking with your hands. And what it means that when we play, we automatically engage in exploration through experimentation. And we are doing that with our hands. So building, breaking, putting things together, digging, opening, turning over, you know, play acting. If you think about all that, as I mentioned earlier, we are creating model of like building models. And these models is what we get a chance to hypothetically create one and then modify them as we go along, you know. So by the time children enter kindergarten, all this kind of stuff is taken away from them. You know, the kind of exploration they do with their hand is hardly that robust in the classroom. So this is why we are kind of getting it wrong, I feel, in a way, you know?
Well, I'm thinking about when you were mentioning the parents that were like chaperoning and almost like guiding the play. My parents certainly didn't do that. I would get up in the morning and have breakfast and I'd be gone. And I wouldn't come home until I heard the bell ringing for dinner, you know? And then certainly when I was at home, my parents weren't sitting there with me, watching me build Legos. I mean, they didn't tell me what to build. I mean, but it's real clear to me now, obviously, that if parents want to see their kids thrive, you got to let them play.
Yes. And you got to let them play literally means let them loose. You know, I was reading this amazing book by Jennifer History, and she's written All Joy, No Fun. This is about parenting. And she talks about the 100-year evolution of parents. Lives of parents as we began to live in suburbs and how mothers became in charge of driving their children to activities from activity to an activity after school. And pretty much the child was spends most of his time with an adult in the car. Now with the technology last 20 years, I mean, maybe 10 years, the children who are driven by their mothers or nannies are not talking to anybody. So that's another, can you imagine stifling the whole expression side of your own development? Mm-hmm. So yes, play is critical in development of problem solving. I cannot emphasize enough. And it also is very critical for social development. So yes, I mean, I think right now, if we are stuck in artificially creating play, go ahead, let's do it. I often recommend people in my practice to go and enroll their children in acting class or improv. I think that probably is one of the places where they are forced to pretend and role play, and they get lines fed and they have to emote using those lines. So it is a little bit structured and artificial, but it probably closest to the play. It's a play for non-imaginative people.
Now, improv is a great strategy because it does teach you a lot of things. I mean, there's a lot of businesses that employ that now for a lot of different reasons. You know, and thinking of that, you know, and now that I'm better understanding the definition of what play is, I mean, there's obviously play all around us. And we should probably talk about adults at play. I mean, we should be allowed to play too, because that can be fun. We're allowed to have fun. Talk more about that, please.
I know. And what a fantastic reference. Yes, yes, yes. I really think we all should play, and play is nothing but what we describe in adulthood, creativity, smarts, and right side of the brain kind of thinking. But in adult life, the play emerges as an element of surprise, brings kind of excitement in everyday life and in your relationship. Let me give you an example of Anna and Terry, a couple from Australia. They began to date, and a token of his love on their first anniversary, Terry handicrafted a beautiful pendant necklace for his fiancée out of Huna pine. I think it's only found in Tasmania, Australia. But anyway, a year and a half later, Anna and Terry traveled all the way to Smoo Cave in southern Scotland, where they had always talked about visiting. And as they were descending into the cave, Terry said, "Hey, Anna, can I just borrow your necklace? I want to take some pictures." So she thought nothing about it, and so she gave it to him. And funniest thing happened next. So he put the camera in the cave, and you can see this on the on YouTube. I'll link it in my podcast here. But apparently what he did is the necklace, the pendant, actually was not a hole. It was hollow inside. And he had carved inside and made a place for an engagement ring. So he had placed that engagement ring inside this necklace a year and a half earlier. She just didn't know it. And
wow,
so what he had
awesome.
To isn't that great? And so what he had to do is like crack it open. So, and then he got on his knees and proposed, and she was just bowled over that. What? How thoughtful of him. And what's so crazy about this, Smoo, by the way, is a kind of a Norse word, which means hiding place. So the double entendre there, you know, he created a necklace, which was a hiding place, and he took her to a hiding place to propose. So this is what I mean. Like, this is a fantastic example of play, isn't it?
Absolutely. I love it. I love it. You know, Sucheta, thinking more about play, and I mean, that was a great story, but I wish families did that. I mean, does your family do like puzzles and that kind of stuff?
Yes. Oh my God. We are big, 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 big on play. And, you know, we're a little bit nerdish because we love to do like word puzzles, and we love to do kind of math puzzles, and we send each other jokes and riddles all the time. I'll send you, and of course, my children kind of make fun of us now, but more so of my husband, who tends to send like silly jokes a lot, you know. But I'll give you an example. You know, recently in our WhatsApp group that he shared this cute, I guess they can be called riddles or puns, I guess. I don't know what the right term is, but here you go. Okay. Yep. Energizer bunny arrested, charged with battery.
Oh, God.
So stupid, right?
But you know what? But that's play, though. I mean, that is play. And
it really is. It's like making fun of yourself or laughing at something which is kind of stupid. Okay, I'll give you a few more, two more, okay? Without geometry, life is pointless.
Oh, goodness.
Oh, and the best one is this. A successful diet is the triumph of mind over platter.
Oh, my. Those are awful, but great at the same time.
Well, try to remember in a casual conversation, try and tell somebody that. You never remember these punchlines and funny jokes or riddles, right? But yeah, that's something I think brings a great joy when we are together. We play cards. We have these elaborate games. When my children were growing up, I used to always tell them this incredible made-up story that went on for years. It was called Chinchinake Bubliboo. This was a man who had magic powers. And so every night when kids went to bed, I would make up a story. So somehow, I don't even know how we landed on that. My mother used to use this term, Chinchinake Bubliboo. So that's how I picked it up. And I made up this story. And my kids got so enthralled in it that every night I had to lie to them and come up with something elaborate. And it's so, so cute. But it lasted like for a year at least, or two. But, you know, that was one of our little things, that this imaginative, and my children are very imaginative and they're very playful. My older son, I spoke to him on Sunday and he was riding his bike. And I said, where are you going? So he said, well, I'm going to the train station. He lives in Manhattan. And then he said, I'm going to take the train. I'm going to Long Island or Hampton Beach or somewhere. And he said, well, I'm taking apart a murder mystery and I have a specific costume and a role. So he's 23. And yes, he was looking ridiculous as he rode his bike that was not his in the middle of Manhattan on Saturday morning.
But, you know, I mean, we would need another hour to just talk about this, the powerful benefits of just play within just a family environment or just typical relationships in terms of strengthening those, building trust. I mean, there's just so much benefit to this and all stems from play.
Yeah. And, you know, like if you take example of the way we communicate with others, we are using a name, like take example of a name. You know, I named my practice Cerebral Matters and I wanted to do this double entendre, you know, cerebral matters, matters of the cerebral, matters of the brain, and brain matters in your life. Yep. And, you know, I'm looking for like clever ways people come up with ideas and clever ways they share with the world. For example, Elon Musk has founded a new company. It's called the Boring Company, B-O-R-I-N-G. But it is literally a company, a drilling company, you know, so there's a tongue-in-cheek nature to things, which kind of takes you to this childlike innocence in things where you have curiosity and joy for watching something that works. You know, when we lived in Boston there, I always made a point when we went to Cambridge to visit this store. The name of the store was Games People Play. And guess what they sold, Todd? They sold games.
It's old games, yeah.
It was so fun. So yeah, I'm a sucker for that. I love that.
Well, what you're talking about there, if I'm picking up on the cue here, is that this is kind of like signaling. I mean, this is an invitation out there to invite us to engage in playful banter and playful activity. I mean, that's kind of what these, like what your company name is, what the boring, and that's what that is, right?
Yeah, and we are saying, so what is, after all, play invitation? Invitation, it's opposite of aggression. Aggression says stay away or else. And play says come closer, so we shall, yep. You know? Yep. So it is an invitation for intimacy. It is also an invitation for social bonding. It's an invitation to say, let's kind of get rid of each other's stress. Let's play. So it's so great, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. And I hope people will accept more of those invitations because they're all around us. All right. So as we're wrapping things up with this this episode, let's talk about what both parents and teachers should be taking away from this discussion today.
Yes. So the biggest takeaway is twofold. One is executive function at heart means problem solving. And problem solving is a skill that you learn not by going and taking a class. It is literally engaging in some sort of hypothesizing. And our next episode, we are going to talk about daily problem solving, but I'm setting the stage through play to talk about problem solving. And the second thing is, play is the seat of creativity. So creativity is nothing but looking at a problem from a novel perspective in a self-initiated way and for the sake of solving the problem and to in order to create joy. So we can't necessarily make children creative in a scripted way, but we can certainly create an environment where they begin to play and play with ideas in an effort to fit those ideas together to generate a solution. So one needs the space and a fertile land where they can play or flirt with ideas and sow the seeds of creativity. So it is a kind of engaging in the world in a free fall manner and let the ideas take shape in a creative ways. You know, parents need to feel comfortable and confident that their kids can be allowed to make chaos their home. And they should be kind of engaging in non-academic tasks where they play so that they can take those skills and apply. So arts, music, theater, acting, these are some of the places where experiences are provided to the children in a way that it acts as a rich soil for children to be carefree and yet very safe. And finally, I will say that we need to really aspire for creativity because it's an ultimate expression of joy. So do you know, Todd, that Einstein claimed that his theory of relativity was a magical musical thought? You know, as a child, he took the self-initiative and showed interest in learning violin on his own, and he taught violin to himself after listening to Mozart. But that kind of, he described that was the foundation of his musical thought. What a beautiful way to think about, isn't it?
Well, it's an example of how play generates ideas and more whimsy, and it frees up the mind to be more creative on other endeavors. I mean, it's just, it proves the point.
And, you know, I know we are ending here, but I just want to share one quick study. You know, there's a scientist who, there's a psychologist who studied a Nobel Prize winning scientist. And you know what they found? They found some incredible science behind or themes that emerged that these scientists were twice likely to play a musical instrument. They were seven times more likely than an average person to draw or paint. And 12 times more likely to write fiction or poetry. And finally, 22 times more likely to perform as a dancer, actor, or a magician. So imagine, like, it's a myth to think that if you have a scientific thought or scientific mind and a mathematical inclination, then you cannot be engaging in the artistic side of the world. No, in fact, when they combine together, it leads to the highest form of creativity. So let's play, Todd. Let's let people play and let's enjoy life. And as we do that, we are going to be free from all the worries because we're going to get to practice how to worry in a scripted way and then let that worry go, isn't it?
It's absolutely the case. And I am going to encourage more playtime amongst certainly all my colleagues. Great, great stuff. All right. That's all the time we have for today. If you know of someone who might benefit from our very own whimsical podcast episode today, we'd be most grateful if you would kindly forward it to them. So on behalf of our host, Sucheta Kamath, and all of us at Cerebral Matters, that means something more to me now. Thanks for listening today, and we look forward to seeing you again right here next week on Full Prefrontal.
Thank you for listening to Full Prefrontal, exposing the mysteries of executive functions. To contact our host, Sucheta Kamath, and learn more about her work on improving executive functions, visit her website at CerebralMatters.com. That's CerebralMatters.com. Tune in next week for the next informative episode of Full Prefrontal.